New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. Now get a savory sausage McMuffin with egg, plus hash browns, and a small coffee for just $5.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Okay, welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio and the Big E Sports Show. And over the past couple of weeks, we have been providing a recap of the NFL draft that was certainly full of some surprises and plenty of intrigue and storylines. And we have invited on our show this evening well-known sports agent Lee Steinberg, who throughout the years has represented 60 first-round picks in the NFL draft, including a record 8 number one selections. He has quite a resume. It's such a pleasure to have you with us on this Friday night, Lee. Good to talk to you.
It's my pleasure.
Well, personally, I have to tell you, it has always been fascinating watching the draft and wondering what does go on behind closed doors with the negotiations and determining what is the right fit. So first of all, let's just get your insight on what teams received the highest marks and what teams really knocked it out of the park in terms of your estimation. Give us that Lee Steinberg report card.
I think the St. Louis Rams did extremely well in their draft. The San Francisco 49ers, I think Cleveland did well. I think Houston has to get a good grade, even though it was sort of surprising they didn't take a quarterback till later. If you're sitting in New York as one of the top draft picks, draft time is not real time. It's water torture time. So even though I may have done my best to brief a client about where their possibilities are, with 10 minutes between picks, time attenuates, so you have a second that seems like a minute seems like an hour, and it goes drip, drip, drip. So there really isn't a day of more exultation and joy than draft day, because here a young man has been working for this goal since he was in Pop Warner football, and it includes a family and friends and supporters, and it is tense and anxious, and all of a sudden there's a burst of complete joy, and it's one of the most wonderful things. It's what keeps someone wanting to represent players.
Absolutely. A myriad of emotions. Hey, we are going one-on-one with Lee Steinberg. He is the president, the CEO of Steinberg Sports and Entertainment. A little bit later in our interview, we are going to highlight the book that he had released this past fall. You just identified, you highlighted, Lee, some of the teams that had exceptional rookie classes. You mentioned the Cleveland Browns. I thought first-year Browns general manager Ray Farmer did an outstanding job. Manziel stands out in that particular class in terms of the prospects, but you throughout the years have represented so many elite Hall of Fame quarterbacks, a Warren Moon, Troy Aikman, a Steve Young. In your estimation, Johnny Manziel, what kind of impact do you see him having in Cleveland, and do you see it happening right away?
What happens today is because of the salary cap, there's no ability to put a high-round young quarterback behind a wily veteran for a couple of years, the way Aaron Rodgers learned anymore. That player has to start because there's so much cap money wrapped up in him. And normally, the quarterback transition is something that would take a year, 2 years, 3 years before that quarterback can read the defense accurately and have field command. But today, we throw him right out there. The danger is that with viral media and hundreds of commentators on talk radio and the blog, newspapers, television, all of a sudden, if a quarterback struggles early, he can be adjudged to be a bust. Now, Manziel has freakish abilities. He can do things to extend a play that rarely we've seen. He also has an inherent knack at bringing a team back, so no game is really out of reach. It's going to be an adjustment for him to the pro game. For example, he never used a playbook at Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
This is the essential guide to running a team, and quarterbacks have to master it. So now all of a sudden he has his first playbook, which is amazingly complex and intricate in terms of memory challenges that he has to deal with. Having said all that, I think he'll be successful. The line he walks is between making it clear to everyone he's going to be a football-committed athlete as opposed to an endorsement magnet. And he may have more publicity than any player coming into the sport in years and years and years. That gives him great commercial opportunities. The problem is that to come into a veteran team and have an owner and a coach and your teammates and the fans of the city all judging you on football, and you come in with this incredibly high profile, then it almost sets him up to get judged more harshly.
Super Agent Lee Steinberg is joining us at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We'd love to hear from you. Join us online at Twitter, at E Radio Sports. And, of course, when we're talking about Johnny Manziel, he certainly entered as the most publicized prospect on the field. As you were reflecting on his career, even at Texas A&M, so dynamic and exciting player. You said his ability to extend plays, he provides that positive yardage. What is the biggest hurdle, though, that you see that he has to overcome with the Cleveland Browns? You're talking about learning the playbook, and how quickly do you see him fitting in?
Well, I think one of the difficulties is they lost their star wide receiver, who looks like he's going to be out for a year. So the quarterbacks who do well early are those that have strong offensive lines, a great group of offensive threats at the skill positions, and a good defense, so that you don't have to do much initially. We were fooled and deluded by the first-year success of Andrew Luck and RG3 and Russell Wilson, because it made it look as if this is just an easy transition. It's probably the most difficult transition in all of football, that of a quarterback going from college to the pros. So I think he'll end up being fine. He cannot expose himself out on that football field as he did in college, when he's extending plays to getting hit, because injury will result. We're talking about players who are bigger, stronger, faster, can cover more ground, can deliver a G-force hit that's much more dynamic. And so he's going to have to be careful in the amount he exposes himself to getting knocked out of games.
What is your overall take in terms of rookie quarterbacks? Do you believe in sitting them, redshirting them that first year? I mean, the long-term positives, you know, it allows them to learn the system, to work on the mechanics, and there is that adjustment period.
I'd rather have a sit on the bench and be used in spots in the first year to adequately develop them. I mean, if you look at the most successful quarterbacks in the game and you look at Tom Brady or you look at Aaron Rodgers, these are players that did not start immediately. And then you see an RG3 who couldn't do in his second year what he did in his first year. So, by and large, I think that's the right way to bring a quarterback along. But the financial structure of football doesn't support that anymore. Again, to manage a salary cap, a team needs to have a level of superstars, and behind them are going to be rookies or aging veterans. And it's the only way to balance the economics. So there's no margin. So notwithstanding what I think, top pick quarterbacks are going to start right away in most situations.
But as a quarterback, I mean, how can that truly prepare you for live games, situational, you know, replicating that type of level of connection, competition? Because when you're out in the field, the physicality is so much different than just going through reps during practice and scrimmages.
The key is, can someone master a playbook? Can they learn behind someone? And eventually they'll get their chance. I remember talking to Warren Moon once, and he told me that in his first year at quarterback, he was doing it mostly on his legs and at times had very little idea of what was going on. Remember that Manziel comes out of a sort of structure where they don't really read defenses. They have a set group of plays, and they go ahead and execute them. So it's that part of it's going to be tricky. Fortunately for him, he seems to have an innate ability to flat dominate a football field and has the ability in adverse circumstances to somehow improvise his way out of it. So we'll see.
Lee Steinberg is with us at YSR, the Big East Sports Show. It is time, as we're up against the clock, to take a commercial break. We'll be rejoined with Lee Steinberg right here at YSR. Lee Steinberg joining us this evening at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. We know him well. Hey, he is the president, the CEO of Steinberg Sports and Entertainment. I want to get a quick hit. Talk to us about Blake Bortles. Give us a sense of what the future holds for him, because I was surprised to see him go so early in that first round.
He has all the conventional attributes necessary to be a good quarterback. The problem he has is he's in Jacksonville, which has been a team struggling for a number of years. They, back in 1995, when they were put together, by the second year, they were fighting to be in the Super Bowl. But that's not Jacksonville of today. So they went ahead and drafted some receivers that'll be helpful, but he's someone that is, I think, will greatly enhance the team, but he's got more challenges than any other quarterback because he's got the weakest surrounding cast.
Okay, so our home base for Yahoo Sports Radio, we're right here in Houston, and obviously a lot of excitement about the Texans landing Jadeveon Clowney. Would you agree that he is a once-in-a-generation type player? I mean, a very rare talent.
It's interesting because in my visits to Houston, the subject of Johnny Manziel was at the forefront. And I personally, if I had a franchise, would have taken a quarterback. Because the theory is that when a team is that high up in the draft, meaning they didn't do very well the year prior, the quarterback position is so difficult to fill. Having a player that they can build around for 10 to 12 years, a franchise quarterback that they can win because of rather than with, and someone who can elevate his level of play in critical situations to put a team on his back and take them through to victory, playoffs, Super Bowl, is the real key today. And so Clowney is an incredibly gifted player. The only knocks on him were his relationship with Steve Spurrier and the fact that Spurrier felt he didn't practice all the time. But he's a gifted talent. Having said that, and certainly with paired with J.J. Watt, that's a frightening prospect for any team. Still, you need the quarterback. And
right,
they didn't draft until I think the fourth round or the fifth round, they didn't draft the quarterback there. So I think Clowney is going to be an instant impact on the team. One of the positions you can play right away because it involves rushing the passer is the position he'll play. And the fact that someone who's 260 pounds could run a 4.5 40 is Ripley's believe it or not, but the reality of the situation is they may be really strong defensively, and they know what they're doing. Rick Smith is a talented GM, but the problem with it is that without the trigger guy, you may struggle.
Certainly a savvy move if you're talking about the general manager, Rick Smith, with the Houston Texans. Any concern in terms of his work ethic, him being soft a little bit?
I think that he's going to be highly motivated. Being picked first in the first round, which is a situation I've been in 8 different years, is such a stunning honor. I think he'll use the doubters to motivate himself. And what happens is it's a meritocracy in the NFL. And the veteran players don't particularly care how good he was in college. If he doesn't fit in and hit the same work ethic that the other players do, they'll let him know about it very quickly. And but I see him as someone who's hyper-motivated to be a Hall of Fame-type player And I predict he'll be a savage force in the NFL quickly.
You're listening to the voice of Lee Steinberg, the president, the CEO of Steinberg Sports and Entertainment. Of course, this past fall released his book. It is titled The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game. And it certainly was very revealing in your memoir. It just talks about, obviously, and highlights your unparalleled success, made you synonymous with the term, as I had even said, a super agent. But you also share some of the lows, your struggle with alcoholism, and really how sobriety helped give you that second chance and launch a comeback. But I got to ask you, what is the key to being one of the, or if not the most successful agents in this business?
I think it's listening skills in many ways. It's the ability to draw out of someone their deepest anxieties and fears and their greatest hopes and dreams so that they can be uniquely worked with. People think it's suasion, but actually it's listening. And I think our concept that an athlete can be a role model, retrace his roots, go back to the high school community, collegiate, professional, and set up programs. So, for example, in Houston, Warren Moon did a scholarship at his high school, at his junior college, his college, and then had the Crescent Moon Foundation that sent hundreds of kids back to school, or Ray Childress, who played for the Oilers, went ahead and put together a Criminator Foundation that helped deal with at-risk youth. If a player will do that, then the second career path ends up very easy. So three of our players, for example, are minority owners of actual teams. They are no longer greeters in front of Las Vegas. They're people that can go out and be successful in business, in politics, in media, and make a difference.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you this evening at YSR, the Big East Sports Show, and we will stay in touch. Thanks, Lee.
My pleasure.
You bet. Much more straight ahead at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Okay, we are back at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. And as promised in our next segment, the NBA conversation, it does continue right here in the Quicken Loans Studios. Always a pleasure to welcome back one of our strong, our steady NBA contributors. And he is the senior NBA analyst with Basketball Insiders, Mr. Bill Ingram. Good to have you with us on this Friday night. How are you, Bill?
Always a pleasure, especially with the NBA at the height of the excitement that you can possibly have with all with the conference finals winding down, and we're prepared to see who will be crowned champion this year.
That's right.
Where it's at.
Yeah, and we're going to break that down here in just a second, but I definitely want you to weigh in on the drama that continues with the Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling. As earlier this week, what was it, on Tuesday, Bill, he was arguing that there is no basis for stripping him of his team because he said his statements were illegally recorded. I mean, it's such a sad commentary, but I guess it was predictable, wasn't it?
Well, it is. He's grasping at straws. He's figured out that he's going to lose his team, and he's trying to find some way, some wiggle room. But, I mean, the bottom line is, if he had made the comments, it's unfortunate to have to feel that way, first of all. There's no question it's saddening, really, that someone would feel that way, especially someone who owns a professional team in a sport that is predominantly African-American or largely African-American. And to be able to feel that way and yet do what you do, it just I don't even understand how you can compartmentalize yourself to that extent. But I guess he has. Thing is, his comments, how in whatever context he made them or however they became public, yes, they were made in private, and oh, he was distraught or whatever. But bottom line, he made those comments, and they were made public. And from the moment they were made public, he became responsible for those comments. Those comments became a reflection on the NBA and its players because of his position as an owner. In order to repair that, he needs to be removed from ownership. And perhaps he won't learn the lesson we'd like him to learn, which is to not be a racist. You can't make someone not be racist. But what you can do is remove someone who is openly and vehemently racist out of the picture and make him do something else that is not involved with our great game that has come so far since the days of racism. And we just can't afford as a society, much less as a sport, to return to that kind of thinking or allow that kind of thinking to exist.
Absolutely. The senior NBA analyst with Basketball Insiders is joining us at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. That is Bill Ingram. And so, Bill, I'm sure you have it marked. It's circled on your calendar. What, June 3rd is when the vote will take place. How do you see this playing out?
You know, it'll be interesting. I would expect it to be unanimous. The only thing I wonder is, you know, Mark Cuban has talked about the precedent that, that it sets. Not so, not that there's, you know, you don't want a, you know, a racist involved in the NBA, but the precedent that it would set in terms of how someone could be removed from ownership. But honestly, I believe that when it comes time to do it, there's no disagreement among NBA owners about what is in the best interest of the league, and I think we're going to see them oust this guy ASAP so that franchise can move forward.
Okay, Mark Cuban, of course, you know, he called Donald Sterling's comments abhorrent. He endorsed the maximum lead punishment. But, you know, he was talking about the slippery slope that, you know, when you start removing people from the NBA or any organization based on private thoughts or at home, did you understand where he was coming from on those particular statements?
I do, absolutely. I have this conversation all the time with friends, not in the basketball realm, but in the realm of politics, where you start singling out one group. I don't care what the group is. You single out gay people and say, gay people should not have this right or that right or whatever. And you go, okay, well, that doesn't affect me because I don't happen to be gay. However, what if the next thing does affect me? What if it's people with brown hair? I have brown hair. You know, that was certainly going on in Nazi Germany. Oh, you're not blonde hair, blue-eyed. Well, mm-hmm. you're, you know, mm-hmm. that's the slippery slope. You allow one thing to become one thing that you can single someone out and say, because of this, you're going to get X punishment. It is. It's a very slippery slope. But at the end of the day, the NBA is a business. And the business of the NBA cannot tolerate those kinds of expressed feelings, those kinds of ideas that are being expressed. And if you do that, you know, it's detrimental to your business. That you've got players that don't want to play for the Clippers because of that. You've got, you know, all kinds of stuff that would come as a result. Not to mention fans not wanting to buy tickets. And so, you know, it's just a big snowball that can turn into something really ugly. The smartest thing to do is nip it in the bud right now and be done with it.
Basketball Insider senior NBA analyst Bill Ingram is joining us on this Friday night at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. Let's pause. Bill, tell all the listeners nationally where they can go and check out some of your work online.
Well, I am at The Rocket Guy on Twitter, first and foremost. You can always find me there. But then I am senior NBA analyst for BasketballInsiders.com. So if you're looking for the best, latest information, not only me, but my team certainly does an outstanding job of covering the league and all the issues that are going on and all the excitement as well.
Yes, I have to share with all of our listeners, I know you're doing daddy duty right now, so we're listening in on some of the background noise there, but we appreciate you joining us. Talk to us a little bit about, as far as it is crunch time right now with the coaching search, and what are some of the rumors that you're hearing in terms of filling these vacant head coaching positions, because still many NBA teams are looking to fill that void with their head coach.
Well, there are, and I think one thing that's I'm sure playing a role in it is that Derek Fisher, who probably will be a prominent name mentioned once he's finished playing with the Thunder when their season ends, whenever that might be, you know, he's going to be someone they're going to want to interview, especially the Knicks and Lakers, I would imagine, because he's had such a prominent role with the Lakers, and he's been mentioned in connection with the Knicks' job. But, you know, I think that's number one. But number two, you have these two prominent franchises that are not exactly poised to return to greatness immediately. So you're looking for a coach who's going to be willing to take some losses, including the heat that comes from that. When you talk about the way the media just swarms those teams and the fans, you know, you lose two games in a row and it's the end of the world and fire everybody and trade everybody. And, you know, they're going to lose a lot of games. So there are a lot of issues really to think about there. And I think that's why the Lakers and Knicks are still kind of struggling with their coaching search.
Is Derek Fisher, is that your personal favorite to become the Knicks head coach? I mean, Phil Jackson's, you know, searching for a coach he believes that can run the triangle offense.
Well, you know, that's a big part of it. The other reason I really like Derek Fisher, I like him personally. He's a very good person. He's got a good head on his shoulders, very intelligent guy. He also has the respect of the entire league in terms of the players because of the fact he was president of the Players Association for so long and handled that role well. So I think he has a lot of respect from the players. I think he's obviously, his accomplishments on the court speak for themselves. He's one of these guys that's really been a phenomenal player for championship teams. He's made big shots at big times, very clutch player, a guy that's been, you know, hugely responsible for amazing things that have happened on the court as well as his reputation off the court. So I think this is a guy that would really be, he's ready for that next step. He's ready to be a head coach, and he would command the kind of respect, both he would handle himself well enough too to be the coach for a team that, yeah, maybe they're going to take some licks, but there's going to be a lot of confidence in him, even if the team struggles because of personnel.
And we're seeing so many teams where players are turning into coaches. It just seems like that is the trend now. It's much more appealing to NBA execs. Of course, Jason Kidd comes to the forefront of my mind. Talk to me about Lionel Hollins. Why has he not landed a job yet? I mean, very successful at Memphis. I've got a lot of belief in this guy.
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, let's just say many of the current coaches in the NBA were players. that's not a new trend, but it is certainly, it's very popular right now, as you've mentioned. I do think that the thing with Lionel Hollins, he's not warm and fuzzy. He's not, he's very much a tough love, this is how it's going to be, like it or lump it kind of coach, and you have to have a particular kind of team that's going to respond to that the right way, which, you know, the Memphis Grizzlies largely did. Mike Conley, Zach Randolph, Marc Gasol, we're talking about very coachable guys, then Tayshaun Prince. It's a team of guys that are very coachable, and, you know, they're going to take that criticism and not just blow up at him, you know. Whereas he starts jumping down the throat of, say, Kobe Bryant, and things might not go quite as
right.
Well. So I think that's number one. I think Lionel Hollins is a very good coach, and I think he'll find a spot. But I think we're going to wait and see where some other coaching open vacancies might happen, and he might be a better fit somewhere else. I don't see that being the case with the Lakers at all. And as we've mentioned, I think Derek Fisher is probably the only reason the Knicks haven't chosen a coach is because Derek Fisher is still playing.
What is the future for Mark Jackson?
Well, the thing with Mark, and I've heard this from people around the organization, the Golden State Warriors, is that he was not the one doing a lot of the X's and O's and the strategic coaching. That was Mike Malone. And Mike Malone left to go coach the Sacramento Kings, not as talented or together a team, obviously, so he didn't have success the first season, but he's building a program there, and I think that's probably a solid way to go. That left Mark Jackson to then have to be the coach. Well, primarily what Mark Jackson does is preach, and that is fine, and it can be inspirational, but when you get into a playoff series and you need real strategy, and you got a coach who's not a strategy coach, you know, it's kind of like what happened to Houston. You see a very talented team that, you know, in the case of the Rockets, much more talented than their first-round opponent from Portland, but because they had a better coach, better strategies, you know, they wound up winning. So that's a situation where I think you look at Steve Kerr, and this is a guy who is not only an outstanding analyst, as he's done, you know, on TV, but also has a strong reputation as a front office exec, built a very competitive team in Phoenix, and you talk about building a new culture. You know, the culture that you have to build, and that has a lot to do with the coach. And Golden State is a team that is poised to win and win soon. And so the right coach might be all that's missing and maybe a tweak here and there, but the right coach is certainly a huge part of it.
Basketball Insider senior NBA analyst Bill Ingram has been with us at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. We always appreciate it. We'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks, Bill.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead on this Friday night. Okay, we are back inside the Quicken Loans Studios at YSR on this Friday night in our final segment. And right now it is time to head to Lincoln, Nebraska. We're going to check in with Husker great, one of the best, all-time best defensive players that have ever been a part of the game in college football, a three-time national champion, our very own Jason Michael Peter, the Double Nickel, number 55. How are you, Jay?
I'm good. How are you, E?
Hey, I'm doing great. And this week, our conversation, we're going to lead off with the announcement of the College Football Hall of Fame class inductees. I'm not going to rattle off the whole class. It was nice to see. How about those Horned Frogs? TCU's LaDainian Tomlinson. He's going in. The late Derek Thomas. It's overdue. He will be going in as well. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts on this year's class?
Yeah, I think it's a good class. An old teammate of mine in Carolina, Wesley Walls, who was an Old Miss tight end / defensive end. I think he might have been the last player besides, obviously, Miles Jack, who's doing it now out at UCLA. He might have been the last player to kind of, you know, go two ways. You have Charles Woodson. Obviously, he was returning kicks and playing defense. But, overall, I think it's hard to argue these classes, it's usually about the guys that didn't get in. You know, last year, Tommy Frazier had been on the ballot for a few years, and he hadn't gotten in, and a lot of people look at him as, you know, arguably the best college quarterback to ever play the game. But sometimes you just got to wait. and eventually, you know, these guys, they usually, if they don't have any kind of adversity hanging over their head, there's a good chance that they'll get in. It's just a matter of when.
I'm glad that you bring that up. What about Sooner great Brian Bosworth? I cannot believe he still hasn't gone in. Do you think he deserves it?
Yeah, I do. You know, besides what he did on the field, the Bos was just such a part of college football, and really the rise in popularity. I mean, it went from, you know, just a regular football game when you think back to the whole deal with, you know, him having to sit out and the Orange Bowl. I believe it was the Orange Bowl, and you know, it turned it into just from a regular game into almost a spectacle. And what was the Bos going to do? And was he going to be out on the field? And, you know, is he going to walk out for the captain's toss? And, you know, I remember that. And I was just a little kid. And, you know, certainly you're going to have the people that argue, you know, he tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs. But let's face it. I mean, most guys back then were juicing,
mm-hmm.
and it was, you know, he got caught. And sometimes, you know, it's the same as what's happening in Major League Baseball. You have all these guys, and, you know, look at Braun. I mean, he stood in front of us saying, I never, ever, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, you know, it's just the way of the times, I think. And back then, it was something that was accepted. And really, the NCAA had just started testing for steroids. So, you know, you could see how some guys are on the fence. But I just think when you look at the impact that he had on college football, there are a few guys that have had a greater impact than the Bos.
Each and every week at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show on Friday nights, we are joined with Jason Peter with our weekly Under the Helmet segment. And I was thinking back, Jason, just a few years ago, what, in 2009, your very best friend, Grant Winstrom, one of the all-time greats from the University of Nebraska, he was inducted and to be recognized, you know, with college football's greats. What were some of the emotions? I mean, what was that like for him? And I know that you and your wife, you guys were up in New York for the ceremony.
Yeah, it's a special night. You know, I remember that like it was yesterday, and it certainly meant a lot to Grant. But then to have, you know, Dick Vermeil there and Tom Osborne and Charlie McBride and really all the people that have been close to Grant and have had an impact on his career. You know, they were all there to share in it along with his family and a few other people. But yeah, it's such a great night. And you know, for these guys, I mean, most guys aren't like Grant though. You know, most guys when they're going in, they're, you know, maybe late 40s, usually in their 50s. I mean, Grant was, you know, 35, 36. And, you know, it really goes to show what type of player and career he had, because, you know, he was a two-time first-team All-American, not just out on the football field, but in the classroom. You know, he was a recipient of one of the top eight award, where he was one of the top eight student athletes in all of the NCAA. And, you know, a pharmacy major, you know, he was basically pre-med.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, I, living with him, I don't know. I think, you know, some people, they just have some of those that book smarts, because it's not like he came home and you know, locked himself in a room for, you know, the rest of the night and you never saw the guy. I mean, he was still social. We were still able to have normal lives. He was a normal roommate, and you know, I feel lucky that I was able to play alongside him.
Grant Winstrom, certainly one of the greatest defenders to ever play at Nebraska, a 9-year veteran in the NFL, played with the Rams and with the Seahawks. Is he, Jason, the most intense player that you ever saw in college or perhaps even in the NFL?
Whew. You know, this one is kind of real close to the heart here, and talk about intensity. I don't know if there was anybody maybe more intense than my brother Christian. But, you know, when you talk about those Nebraska teams, we all kind of were made of, you know, cut from the same cloth. And certainly there were some guys on the team that weren't so high strung. But when you know, that first ball was kicked, there were a handful of guys that our motors, you know, they were just, they were on high, you know, for 60 minutes. And we just didn't know any other way. But, you know, Grant certainly was one of those guys that was a high motor, a high effort sort of guy. He wasn't the most athletic guy in the room, but he was going to outwork you.
Of course, you know, speaking of Hall of Fames, you were inducted, what, in 2007 into the Nebraska Football Hall of Fame. Your brother was, what, the year before you? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it was something like that.
Right. So we're quickly running out of time. We've got a minute. But just overall, as we wrap up our segment, I mean, what was that like to play, you know, Division One ball, to get to play with your brother and to be alongside him out on the field?
Yeah, it was the main reason I went to Nebraska. You know, I had offers. I could pretty much ride my own ticket. But just that opportunity to be able to play side by side, and you know, that came true in 1995 on what a lot of people think is, you know, the best college football team ever, and to ultimately win two national championships with your brother, you know, it's pretty special. You know, they're the Selman brothers. Obviously, you're familiar with them.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Former Oklahoma brothers that were able to do it, and I don't know if there's anybody else. Maybe there was a set of brothers on the Alabama offensive line that were maybe just did it and won a national championship, but I don't know if there were any that have won back-to-back national championships. But, yeah, it's something that, you know, we cherish, and we feel pretty lucky that we were able to do that.
Well, Jason, it's been great to catch up with you. We look forward to talking next week. And, of course, we'll get into the big headlines with my Dallas Cowboys. Oh, my gosh, Sean Lee, discouraging news. And, unfortunately, he's got that history of knee injuries, but that ACL. So we'll talk next week. Thanks, Jay.
All right, thanks for having me.
And a very special thank you to all of our guests. Our lineup this evening at YSR, the Big East Sports Show, Steve Bortstein with Fox Sports New Mexico, Lee Steinberg, the president and CEO of Steinberg Sports and Entertainment, Fred Clare, the former GM with the Los Angeles Dodgers, Bill Ingram, and George Hencappy. Stick with us each and every week at YSR, the Big East Sports Show. Don't drink and drive. We'll see you next week.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you. And most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you. And most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.